Genesis chapter 4, verse 2. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the earth, it will no longer yield its crops to you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Murder was the crime. Envy was the motive. Let's just step through that story again slowly. I want to highlight a couple of things, and then we're going to deal with the subject of envy in some detail. Cain and Abel start the text off on equal footing. If anything, Cain is above Abel because Cain is the elder brother, Abel is the younger. And they both come to worship God. Abel, who is a shepherd, brings some of his best lambs, his best animals, and not only the best animals, but the best bits of the best animals to give as a sacrifice to God. Cain, who is a farmer, just takes his average fruits. Read it. It's right there in the text. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, but Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. So God is more excited about Abel's offering than he is about Cain's. That sends Cain into a funk. He's just all depressed and angry about that. Here's the thing. God then appears to Cain and begins to talk to him and gives him a chance to come and to set things right. "Look, I'm sorry you're upset, but his offering was better. He tried harder. He gave more. He actually sacrificed. You just did something token. But if you do what is right, won't it be accepted?" "Of course it will," is the implicit answer. "Therefore, come and make a new offering." You see, what originally happens in the text is that it seems that Cain and Abel are both there to worship God. When you look a little bit deeper, really, Cain's just going through the motions. Abel is really coming to give praise to God and to give his all to God. Cain is given a chance to get what he supposedly wanted, right? God's blessing and acceptance and approval. But instead of focusing on the thing that he wanted, he shifts his attention to the one who got what he thought he deserved. And that begins to become the engine that drives this story. Cain is no longer focused on the thing that was the original subject. He's now consumed with the fact that his brother got something that he thinks ought to be his. Maybe because he's a firstborn older brother. Maybe because, I don't know, it takes longer to grow an oak tree or a fruit tree than it does to raise a lamb. I don't know what he thought. But for whatever reason, he felt like God had done him wrong. But you can't be mad at God effectively. I mean, what are you going to do, poke him? So instead, he decides to take vengeance on his brother Abel. "If you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at the door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." That is the very first use of the word sin ever in the Bible. I don't know if you realize that or not. They made it through Genesis 1 through 3 without ever using the word. They talked about evil and things. But first use of the word sin in the Bible. Now note, he hasn't sinned yet. He's angry, but he hasn't sinned yet. His initial downcast. It's not until he allows his anger to grow and to shift and to morph into this envy that is bitter and raging against his brother that he falls into sin. At that point, sin has him, and he fails to master it. Envy is the first recorded sin in the Bible. Murder is the consequence of that envy. Murder is the crime. Envy is the motive. So that begs the question, to me at least, what precisely is envy? What's envy all about? On your handout that you received when you came in, you should have a synopsis. I'm so proud of that pun. A synopsis. Basically, the cluster of negative emotions we're trying to get at with the word envy in the seven capital vices is envy, covetousness, wanting other things that aren't yours, entitlement, having the sense that I deserve, I am owed, it ought to be this way for me. And as I mentioned last week, every vice is a distortion or a perversion of a virtue. In the same way, well, basically, Satan can't create things. Satan can only change things. He can't make them. And so when we see sins, we see things that have been corrupted, not things that are creations, ex cathedra, or ex nihilo, I should say. The virtues that are distorted by these vices are emulation, the notion that we look at someone who's better than us at something, and we seek to imitate them, to grow to be like them, to learn from them. Someone who is more honest. Oh, wow, look at how in this difficult situation, they were able to be honest without being offensive. I can learn from that. Emulation. And it also distorts the virtue of justice. The desire for things to be right and fair. Oftentimes, incidentally, in protest movements, in social justice movements, envy and justice are just a hair's breadth apart. Some people are in the movement for the right reasons. Some are in it for altogether despicable reasons. The underclass, in many cases, some of them, are driven by envy of the overclass, whatever situation you're looking at, whatever culture. Others are driven by a pure drive for justice and for righteousness to prevail in the society. A lot of biblical stories that hit on the subject of envy. I'm not going to cover them all tonight, obviously. We just looked at Cain and Abel. Saul, in the Bible. He was envious of David, even though Saul was king, and David was just like, you know, a peon in his army. Because people loved David more. And Saul grew angry. He could not tolerate David's success and popularity. Korah, in the wilderness. He and his followers just couldn't abide by the fact that Moses and Aaron had been singled out by God for leadership. And they sought to take reins and to seize power and to worship God their own way. Joseph's brothers, Joseph and his coat of many colors, he was flaunting the fact that his father loved him more in front of his brothers, and they were consumed with envy to the point of murderous rage. And they sought to kill their brother. And then when they ultimately drew back from that, they sold him into a lifetime of slavery. The false mother. This is Solomon's most famous story. Two women come to Solomon, each claiming that a baby is theirs. And one mother, the false mother, the one who is not the actual mother of the child, she's just pretending to be, when given the choice between the other woman having the live baby or her having half of a dead baby, says, "I want half a dead baby." Envy. Envy is a bizarre, bizarre thing. And then finally, it says in the Bible, in Mark chapter 5, verses 9 and 10, that Jesus was handed over to the Romans by the chief priests because they were envious of his popularity with the people. People liked Jesus, and that made them burn on the inside. According to the Bible, envy does a lot of things. It poisons our relationships. It harms us physically. It pollutes our souls. It's opposed to love. It's a byproduct of not keeping God in focus. And it's a big enough deal to make it into the Ten Commandments. You remember that in there? Thou shalt not covet. I've asked my wife to come up and to share a story from her college days about how exactly envy can poison relationships.
When I was a freshman in college, I had a good friend. Her name was Janine. And Janine and I, when we first met, we looked like we could have been sisters that had been separated. We had the same haircut. We wore the same glasses. We acted the same. We liked the same things. And everywhere I went, Janine was there. And everywhere Janine went, I was there. And we were, like, inseparable for an entire year. And there were many things that I admired about Janine. She was, I thought, very beautiful, not because we looked I thought she was a very attractive woman. But we were different physically. I was more of the skinny bean type, and she was more of a healthier woman. She was a little overweight. But she was very athletic. She was very, she had a vibrant personality. People liked her. They were attracted to her. Janine had gone through a year-long training in discipleship with this church that I admired in her. And I was just like, wow, that is awesome. I wish I could have done that. I just went to college straight on. A year after our friendship began, I started noticing that Janine and I weren't hanging out as much. We didn't talk as much as we used to. There was just like this rift between us, and I didn't quite know why. And one day I got a phone call from her, and she said, "Hey, can you meet me at the Kappa House? We need to talk." And I was like, "Sure, great. We're going to hang out. Cool." And when I got there, my small group leader was there, and Janine was there, and it was like this big intervention. And Janine said, "Paula, we have a problem." I was like, "Okay, what's the problem?" And she's like, "I am envious of you, and our relationship is hurting because of it." I'm like, "What do you mean you're envious of me?" And she's like, you are popular, you are skinny, you have a boyfriend, and she started naming all these things. It wasn't him. anyway, but she was saying all these things, and I'm just like, what do you mean? And, you know, I, of course, accepted her apology, and we, you know, our friendship never was the same again. And after walking away, I went home, and I thought about it. I was like, how could she be envious of me? If I look back, in all honesty, in the last year, I have been envious of her. She's athletic. I would love to be athletic, but physically I'm incapable of being athletic because of, I have muscular dystrophy. Janine is outgoing. I don't necessarily see myself as an outgoing person all of the time. And I saw that I was envious of Janine. And so the fact that both of us were envious of each other and never talked about it or put it to the side and learned to appreciate it, it pretty much killed our friendship.
So. And Paula and Janine's friendship never recovered after that time. It had gone too far to be patched. Envy poisons relationships. It's a horrible, nasty, nasty thing. That's sort of a snapshot of what the Bible says about envy, but it leaves a lot of questions unanswered, at least in my mind. There are many things that I now want to get a handle on when I think about envy. So the first question I have, is envy the same thing as jealousy? And if so, what's up with all this, I, the Lord, thy God, I'm a jealous God stuff? If envy's a sin and he's jealous, I don't get how this all works out. So is envy the same thing as jealousy? Are those simply synonyms for one another? Answer is no. Envy and jealousy are not synonyms. Jealousy is concerned with things that are yours. Envy is concerned with things that are someone else's. For instance, I am Paul's and she is mine. We are joined in the band of marriage where we have given ourselves to one another. It is not only okay, it is right for me to feel jealous and to express jealousy if I see someone else trying to steal her from me, and vice versa, for her to do the same in my case. That is the right thing to do. In the same way, God is right to be jealous of our affections because we literally belong to him. Envy is something completely different. Envy is, I want what you have. Jealousy is, I want to keep what's mine. Now, I need to add one qualification. Obviously, the English language is not a rigid construct where this word only means this and this word only means this, and these fine nuances are always appreciated. There are times that, you know, everyone uses these words somewhat interchangeably and does not appreciate the distinction between them. And there are times when jealousy is not always appropriate. Jealousy is not a virtue. I didn't put it on here as one of the virtues that is distorted by envy. Because jealousy can be a bad thing. Jealousy can often be inappropriate. For example, I frequently get to observe college students who are dating express inappropriate jealousy. You're acting as though a level of commitment has been violated that was never present there in the first place. There's a whole world of difference between a dating relationship, an engagement, and a marriage relationship. Those are three very different things. I'm not saying no jealousy is ever appropriate, but it's just fascinating to me to watch from the outside. Also, people get jealous over things they think are theirs that aren't really theirs. And that's a very, very weird thing altogether. But jealousy and envy are not the same thing, which is a good thing because God is jealous. In case you didn't know that, one of the best verses for that in the Bible, Exodus 34:14. Do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. God is jealous for you because he loves you and because you belong to him. So whenever you give your affection somewhere else in lieu of him, he gets angry. And appropriately and justifiably so. Does that make sense? Envy and jealousy. Next question that I have, as I began to think about this subject, is, so I'm not supposed to envy. Does that mean I should never want things? Is desire what's bad? Is that what I'm supposed to get rid of? No, absolutely not. The problem is not with wanting a nicer car. The problem is with wanting Sean's car. In case you didn't know, Sean's got this nice little red sports car called Natalie, I think. Yeah. so everybody knows now. Anyway, you see, it's simply if I see a car, I think that'd be nice to own. That's desire. And as long as it is possible for me to own it, it is something that is budgetarily wise for me to consider. There's nothing sinful in that thought. Envy creeps in when I begin to want something simply because it belongs to someone else. will be a good example of this. All right. In the Bible, when we get to the 10th commandment, it says, thou shalt not covet. It doesn't mean thou shalt not want. If it did, then no Christian should ever be a part of any capitalistic society. You would have to like leave and go somewhere else. The only way to be moral. Our entire society is built upon wanting things. Now, hopefully you want them in a healthy way, and there's healthy and unhealthy wanting. We'll talk about that later when we get to greed, for instance, in our list of seven capital vices. But you read the commandment does not say, thou shalt not covet a house. It says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thy neighbor's spouse, thy neighbor's donkey. Thou shalt not covet what belongs to someone else. Don't go after something simply because it's not yours. When you do that, only bad things can result. Only bad things. Now, by the way, if you have a really philosophical mindset, you might be wondering, well, isn't all buying wanting something that belongs to something else? Like, you know, you go to McDonald's, oh, I wish that I could want that Happy Meal. Yet it already belongs to the cursed clown. Darn you, Ronald! No. See, Ronald wants to sell, and you want to buy. It's a match of interest. It's wanting something that someone's not willing to give up. It's a problem. Just in case you're a philosophical nitpicker, there's your solution. Next question that I have, as I think about greed and envy, is envy the same thing as greed and lust? Like, aren't those overlapping concepts? Why would you give three of the four slots on your list of capital vices over to these things if they're all the same fundamentally? Greed, lust, and envy are all different. There's a rather clear distinction between them. I think the best way to illustrate it is with a little excerpt from Joseph Epstein's really interesting book, Envy. New York Times Review of Books, I think, New York Times Press, commissioned a series of books on the seven deadly sins last year. And this is one of the books in that series. Really fascinating little volumes, all about this size. Fun to read. And in Epstein's book, on page 33, he begins to make this point. Studies such as Robert H. Frank's Luxury Fever have shown that people would agree to make less total money so long as they make more than their neighbors. That is, they would rather earn $85,000 a year where no one else is making more than $75,000, instead of $100,000 when everyone else is making $125,000. H.L. Mencken, who took a special delight in the frailties and the pretensions of the democratic spirit, wants to find contentment in America as making $10 a month more than your brother-in-law. Oh, come on. That one deserved a laugh. That was funny. Thank you. So, in other words, greed just says, I want more. In other words, if the choice is greed between $75,000 a year, or rather $85,000 a year, and $100,000 a year, you choose $100,000. Envy's asking a different question. Greed's asking, how much do I have? Envy's asking, how much do I have compared to everybody else? Same thing with lust. Lust simply says, I want to have sexual relations with this person. I want to sleep with this person. Envy says that I'm attracted to this person not because of who they are, what they look like, or, you know, all this stuff. I'm attracted to this person because of who else they are with or have been with. In other words, there's something dark inside me that's being called out independently of the lust or the greed that is also present in those drives. Does that make sense? Not identical. So now that we have a much better handle on what envy is, I think that I'm going to go ahead and cut to the chase. I'm going to deal with the 800-pound elephant that's in the middle of this room. Me. You see, women want me and men want to be me. My height, my hairline, my halitosis, each of these things makes me completely irresistible to others. If you, like millions of others, wrestle with deep-set envy of me and all my awesomeness, then we're going to have an altar call. We can sort that out. No, I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that. But obviously there are things we do not envy in others, and there are other things that we are very prone to envy. There's lots of stuff, in fact, that we never envy. But there are a couple of things that keep coming up as recurrent issues in human life that are going to either be stumbling blocks for you in the future or have already been stumbling blocks for you in the past. I'd like to hit quickly on some of the most common types of envy that we deal with, and then a couple of suggestions about how to deal with them. First thing that people really wrestle with envy over, in my experience and in my own life, is envy over other people's success. When someone else is succeeding at something that we wish we were succeeding at, envy is right at hand to creep in. Flaubert said, "Nothing is more humiliating than to see idiots succeed at enterprises we have failed in." Maybe you're not old enough yet to appreciate how true that is. But it is amazing what will happen to you whenever you see something that you really wanted to nail, you really wanted to excel at, and someone who you are convinced deep down inside is just not as smart, talented, gifted, funny, witty, whatever is you, completely owns you at that enterprise. It eats you up from the inside if you let it. And whether that means that we think someone got a grade that we should have gotten in a class with some sort of a forced ranking, or someone got a promotion that we thought should have been ours, or a scholarship that we really thought we had a shot at and had earned, our essay was just objectively better than theirs. All my friends say so. you know, whatever it is, especially if we suspect at some level there's injustice involved. Oh, it's so-and-so's nephew. That's why he got this thing happened, you know, handed to him on a silver platter. Or, oh, if he wasn't dating her, then this wouldn't have worked out this way. If we think there's something nefarious, envy has really got the potential to just destroy us. Envy over success is probably the most common thing that people wrestle with, especially achievement-driven people like Osei, the kind who get into Stanford. If you have not yet, I can almost guarantee that at some point in your life, you will really wrestle with envy. Because someone who didn't go to Stanford, someone who went to San Jose City College is going to be your boss. they will not be as intelligent as you. They will not read the books you've read. They'll just be better at their job than you are. And it will eat you up if you let it. And so don't let it. If you are allowing yourself even now to begin becoming consumed over someone else's success, someone else's excellence in some arena, you are allowing a really great opportunity in your life to go to waste. The virtue of emulation is being struck down in you, and instead you're allowing yourself to be consumed by envy. If instead you will figure out, now assuming there's no injustice involved, if there is injustice involved, then allow the virtue of justice to be called up within you, not envy. But if there is no injustice, and the other person is just more savvy than you at whatever it is, learn from them, be schooled by them. And then the next time an opportunity comes up for you to excel in this area, you'll be that much better prepared and less likely to be the person who comes out on the raw end of the deal. Something else that we envy in others, people's lifestyles. This is one of the extremely common areas that especially intellectuals, academics wrestle with. Just think about this. Your professors at Stanford, by and large, probably fairly envious people because they went through grade school. They're nailing straight A's, most likely. Go to high school. Go to college. They're always getting the best grades in the class. They're doing really well. They do so well that they feel like they're going to go on and get their PhD. They're going to become professors. They wind up teaching at the top of the academic food chain at a very prestigious university. And they're still making about a third as much money as that guy who sat next to them and slept through calculus, pulled a C+, but decided to go out and make his living in the workforce. Oftentimes, academics are filled with envy because they feel as though they ought to have more than they do in life. They sacrifice so much. They understand this subject better literally than anyone else on the planet, yet no one else values their understanding or their comprehension, at least not in monetary terms. Extremely infuriating. Extremely infuriating. It's very frustrating or very common for students, such as yourselves, have a limited budget oftentimes. You're doing your best to make wise choices with your money. You know, you're saving up money. You're trying to get the money together you need for tuition next quarter or for this overseas study abroad program you're going to be a part of, or, you know, some like a laptop that you really need to do well at school. And you're being very diligent. You're working a job as many hours as you can. And then the guy across the hall is just playing the fool with his money. It's just not being prudent at all. And, you know, is walking home with the iPod, and you're like, oh, man, I really wish I had one of those. Is going, you know, to snowboard at Heavenly, like, oh man, I would like to do that. And even though you sort of intellectually know in the long run, you'll be happier that you've done what you've done, in the short run, it just gets your goat. It just gets your goat. Another area, lifestyle envy comes in. Sexual envy is huge, especially among Christians who were raised in Christian high schools or, you know, youth groups or, you know, some sort of homeschool environment and did that whole true love waits thing. And, you know, they see their friends engaging in what they imagine to be, you know, Roman orgies every night, this wild sexual hedonism. It's amazing how inventive we get on behalf of others, how much fun they must be having that we're not. And even though we believe deep down inside that you know, we're making the wiser choice, it's sort of like summed up by a quote by Woody Allen. Sex without love is an empty experience, but as far as empty experiences go, it's one of the best. Deep down inside, many Christians could have that as their banner cry for their thought life. That, oh man, it's wrong, but boy, I wish... Why couldn't I have gotten saved until after I was 30 or something? Do not walk down that road in your mind. Any of these roads, any arena of lifestyle envy will end in bad things for you. Not for the other person. Envy never hurts the person you're envying unless, like Cain, you wind up killing him or her. But, and it was not so much the envy that was the problem, it was the way you took action on it. But envy is going to hurt you, not them. And so do not allow yourself to be seduced into envying the lifestyle choices you see other making. You're responsible for one life on this earth. Yours. If you become a parent, you adopt responsibility for some others. When you commit to a spouse, you also bring that into your life. But right now in your life, I know you all. You're not married. Got no kids that I'm aware of. Live your life as wisely as you know how. And do not allow yourself to be distracted by thoughts of what others may or may not be experiencing. We envy others' attributes. This is common, especially among talented people. It's ironic. The more that you have in life, oftentimes the more envy that you get. You want to find the most envious people on the planet? Go find the three or four top people in any discipline. Any discipline. You know, what are the three or four best physicists in the world? In this book, actually, Epstein, who himself is an extremely accomplished individual and has met the masters in almost every discipline on the planet because of the circles that he moves in. He makes this fascinating aside at one point. I have rarely found that the three or four most talented people at any discipline on earth have kind things to say about the others. Because, you know, you're a great physicist and you're great at this part of physics, but you're not so good at this. And someone else is, he's getting the publications, first authorships, prestigious, you know, first article in Nature or Science or whatever that you're not because of this. Now, of course, you had it happen to you last month, but man, you're missing out. We often envy others' attributes. You know, we're smart, but they're smart and funny. We're funny, but they're funny and athletic. We're athletic, but they're athletic and musically gifted. There's always an and there. There's and something that we're not good at. You know, I'm handsome, but I'm not tall enough. I'm tall, but I'm not handsome enough. You know, it's whatever. Fill in the blank. This is the most foolish kind of envy of all. Other kinds of envy you can do things about potentially. For example, lifestyle envy. You can make more money, or you can spend your money in different ways. Attribute envy? Look, either you're blonde or you're not. Or I guess you can do hairstyle. That's probably a wrong one. Either you're tall or you're short. Either you're one race or you're another. Either you're one gender or you're another. Incidentally, by the way, you notice that very rarely do you have cross-gender envy. No, seriously. Now, sometimes you have an abstract sort of envy, like, I envy this about men or this about women. But very rarely is the subject of your intense envy a person of the opposite gender. Very rarely do men actively envy women or women actively envy men. Their intellect, their athletic prowess, their beauty. Just for whatever reason, that's very rarely something that happens in people's lives. I don't know what that's worth, but it's just fascinating to me. Just sort of stumbled across while I was doing research for this. I don't know why that is. Probably because, actually, I know why it is. Probably because one of the things we envy is other people's relationships, their spouses, their mates, whatnot. We tend to view people of the other gender as a prize to be won, not as a rival for the things that we want. That's probably 90% of the situation. So do you envy somebody deeply for something they don't have? Is that you? For something you don't have? If so, I have a little phrase for you. Hello, pot! I'm a kettle! You guys are at one of the most prestigious institutions of higher learning on the planet. You are properly the objects of envy, not the subjects of envy. How much more is enough for you? You rank in the 99.9th percentile on any sort of rational scale of privileged people on the planet, whether your parents are wealthy or not, whether you're pulling the A pluses in your class or the C minuses. You're on the way high end. How much more do you need? Just a little bit more? You'll never be satisfied. If you can't be satisfied here, you can never be satisfied. That's all that I have to say about that. Think rationally for just a few minutes, and then also accept that there's some things about yourself you simply can't change. And you can either live with it, or you can die with it. but either way, it's going to be that way in your life. I'll close with this. Sort of an abrupt ending, but that's where I'm at. Of the seven deadly sins, only envy is no fun. Think about it. Gluttony, you got chocolate, sweets, stuff that tastes good. You know, lust has, you know, sex. Anger has that delight in rage. You know what I'm talking about. When you get mad, there's something kind of nice about that. That's why people nurse grudges. There's something that's rewarding about it. Sloth is that feeling, for example, of, you know, you just wake up in the morning, you're like, I should get out of bed and go to class. Nah. Every other one of the seven has a pleasure built within it, not envy. There is nothing pleasant about envying someone else. Envy is the most negative in terms of draining of all the seven. In some ways, also, it is the one that leads to the most violent, destructive behaviors. Envy is responsible for some of the worst wrongs in all of human history. If you are beginning to perceive that you are envious or that you've got a propensity for envy in your life, you've really got to squash that thing now. You really have to work on this before you go on and move into positions of greater influence in society. You know, when you become a spouse and you've got a family who your envy will directly affect. Before you become an employee and you've got a company that your envy will directly affect. A supervisor and employees who your envy will directly affect. You've got to get this thing under control. You've got to do it. As iron is eaten by rust, goes the proverb, so envy consumes its wielder. I don't know what wielder is, but Proverbs, they're crazy things. And the Bible echoes that thought. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 30. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. Tonight, do you have rotten bones? Is there someone specific you can think of? And that's the thing about envy. Envy is specific, not general. If it's general, it's something else. It's greed or lust. An abstract yearning. It's not envy. Envy is specific. It is about a person or people, but usually one, a focus. That darn Susie. Silly Bobby. Oh, you rotten scoundrel. That was my girlfriend. That was, envy has always got a face. If you've got a face in your mind right now, you need to repent. You need to leave that behind. The word repent in the Bible is metanoia. It simply means to turn 180 degrees. To take what you were doing, the way you were going, the attitudes you were holding, the path you were walking down, and to abandon that and to start moving the other direction. Repentance is not a feeling. Repentance is an action. It is actually a collection of actions that involves leaving one thing and going towards the other. If you are allowing yourself to be consumed by envy, if you've got that face, turn away from it. You cannot focus on both envy and God at the same time. That's what got Cain into trouble. If he kept his eyes on God and had his debate with God, Abel, well, he wouldn't still be alive today, but he would have been alive a lot longer. Instead, he started looking at Abel and he was unable to see God anymore. Envy kills, literally, in Abel's case, metaphorically in each of our lives. Envy will rot us out from the inside. It will harm us physically. It will poison our relationships, as Paul shared. And ultimately, it will leave us disappointed because there is nothing good that comes from envy. Nothing. In some ways, it is the most despicable of human emotions. So what I'd like to do is to simply lead us in prayer. Sean, will you be able to... Not Sean, I'm sorry. Song. Will you be able to come and to lead us in just some closing music? Or Sue Ying, can you play on the keyboard? Sue Ying, okay. Just play on the keyboard. As I close in prayer, if you would like special prayer, please feel free to come and to... You know what, actually, Sue Ying, strike that. Strike that. Throw up the last video. I'm going to let this video play in the background. And what I want you to do is, as I pray, begin to meditate on this video and then on if there is any envy in you. And there may not be any. Some people are relatively immune to one or the other of the capital vices. But if you're an envious person and you would like special prayer, I'll be happy to pray for you. If you prefer to pray where you are, you're welcome to do that as well. Join me in prayer.